Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, dialing in today from our office in Nairobi.
In London, I'm Maria Knapp. Welcome to the podcast.
Maria, this is our second podcast of the year and represents a blend of topics from Risk Map 2017, our annual forecast of political, security, and operational risk, plus some geopolitical issues that we think merit a closer look. For a full view of what Risk Map 2017 forecasts for the year to come in geopolitics and security, visit our multimedia website at riskmap.controlrisks.com.
This week, we're going to take a closer look at Kenya and how ambitions to turn that country into a new Dubai may run into the reality of upcoming elections. We'll then have a look at the future of relations between the US, the EU, and NATO in the wake of the Munich Security Conference. Finally, we'll talk about Brazil and Argentina, two countries that are slightly more than fashionably late to the globalization party. But first, let's go, quite literally, to Nairobi, where Chuck spoke with our analyst, Patricia Rodriguez, and her London-based colleague, Vincent Rouget.
Vincent, one of the themes of Risk Map in 2017 is the possibility that there may be three different countries looking to replicate the success of Dubai and create a commercial, logistics, and even high-tech hub here on the African continent. Do you want to lay out the overall proposition of trying to build a place like Dubai in Africa? And then we'll talk briefly with Patricia about the specifics of doing that here in Kenya.
Yes, Chuck. Hi, and good morning. One of the most exciting stories over the last decade in Africa is clearly the progress in infrastructure. We've seen considerable amounts of spending going to infrastructure projects, improving transport and logistics, telecommunication networks and the like. And that's really changing the face of the continent and really propelling it towards the globalized economy. An interesting facet of this is that some countries have even made their entire development strategy around this idea of tapping the globalized economy and trying to emerge as commercial hubs, as gateways to their respective regions, a bit like Dubai in the Middle East or Singapore in Southeast Asia. Small countries like Djibouti, for example, that's using its position strategically on the Red Sea as a gateway for goods entering East Africa and particularly towards Ethiopia. We've seen also Rwanda, for example, in the Great Lakes region trying to emerge and really modeling its economic strategy on the success of Singapore being a fast-moving hub in the region and making it very easy for business to invest and generally presenting a lot of investment incentives. That's, as I said, concerns small countries, Djibouti and Rwanda and the likes. But we've also seen larger countries, more recently like Kenya, for example, trying to jump on the bandwagon and really emerge as commercial gateways in the same sense.
Vincent, thanks for that. Patricia, we've got a very nice view of Nairobi's Westlands neighborhood out the window of our office here. As you look across Nairobi and you think about Kenya, tell us what the size of the opportunity might be here for Kenya becoming a large regional or even international commercial hub. What are the prospects of that coming to fruition, and what might be some of the obstacles in the way?
So in terms of Kenya's position, if you ask any Kenyan on the street, they will already feel that Kenya, and Nairobi specifically, is already the hub for business and commercial activity across the region. And as Vincent mentioned, now we have rivals that are emerging, especially with Djibouti and to some extent Ethiopia. So there's been a lot of interest in this narrative, and Kenya is starting to feel a little bit more threatened. But interestingly, I think we already have a head start here. We already have had significant investment in infrastructure. We have faster and more reliable internet. The government has also developed plans to develop a high-tech city called Konza City. So in terms of opportunity, I think Kenya is well positioned. We have the infrastructure, we have the soft skills, an educated population. So we're well positioned in that sense to become or to develop further into the East African gateway. But on the other hand, we do have rising competition to contend with. It's not enough just to build infrastructure and roads and ports unless you have, goods that you're looking to move, unless you have investment in manufacturing. So what we've seen, for example, in Ethiopia is that the country has taken on significant debt to finance these infrastructure projects. but now has to start thinking about what industries they want to use, you know, their massive roads, their massive investments in energy production. So Kenya is facing somewhat of a similar challenge, but maybe not to the extent as Ethiopia.
Let's focus inwardly for a second. It's absolutely right to point towards external pressures and competition regionally, but, you know, meeting with clients here and just driving around downtown Nairobi, you see the elections posters and the voter registration drives happening on the street corners. Elections are coming up. Do you think that these sorts of economic and infrastructure initiatives will remain a priority through the campaign and through the aftermath of the elections?
I would say yes. Obviously, you know, there's a lot at stake at the coming election, and it ultimately depends on who takes power. We might see more leaning towards populist measures if the opposition does win, but for now we see that the incumbent Jubilee Party is likely to win the election. So if that is the case, then we see broad policy continuity, including on the infrastructure side.
Patricia, thanks for that. Vincent, let me just close with you, if I can, back up in London. What's the sense that you get from looking broadly at the continent and at East Africa and West Africa? What kind of interest are you sensing in these sorts of projects from the investor community, and how much enthusiasm do you think is out there?
The enthusiasm is here, clearly. There is simply a lot of infrastructure gaps to fill and a lot of energy from donors, from bilateral partners, multilateral donors, development finance institutions and the like to help fill these gaps, both with financial support but also technical support. And the fact that countries, small or large, Djibouti or Kenya, are all vying to really, you know, extend their infrastructure and see it as an opportunity to really position themselves as hubs is also key to that progress.
Vincent, thanks for that. As a reminder, a more detailed conversation about infrastructure opportunities in Africa can be found on the RiskMap website, riskmap.controlrisks.com. Patricia Rodriguez here in Nairobi and Vincent Rouget up in London, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Maria, the Munich Security Conference is one of those annual events where the world's most prominent diplomats, generals, and security honchos gather to reassure themselves that the world is safe. This year, the goal fell slightly short, as Washington's policy towards two of the world's most important alliances, NATO and the EU, remains unclear.
I spoke to Dave Lee, our senior Europe analyst, for the outlook on relations between the U.S. and these crucial partners. Thanks, David. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence made a highly anticipated visit last week, the spotlight being his speech on the 18th of February at the Munich Security Conference. Leaders in Europe are anxious to understand the Trump effect in Europe. They're anxious to hear from Trump. Trump sends Pence. So while the president's making foreign policy statements, Pence is doing the business of foreign affairs. Is this an indication of the administration's priorities?
Hi, Maria. I actually don't think this is that unusual from a European perspective. If we go back in recent history, Joe Biden was very much President Obama's point man on Europe, particularly in the first part of his administration. The same was true to an extent of Dick Cheney, Al Gore. So the vice president does have some kind of ex officio form in this area. So it's not actually that unusual, and it's something we'll probably see a bit more of in the coming months and probably in future administrations as well. So Pence himself has said he wants to take an active role in foreign policy following on from Biden. So that's probably the way it's going to be.
And we'll see Trump soon enough in Europe. Is that right?
Yeah, we will. He's due to attend the meeting of the G7, which will be in Sicily at the end of May. So there he'll meet Theresa May again, obviously, Angela Merkel, the new French president should be in place by then, and whoever's in charge of Italy at the time. So plenty of the leaders of the bigger countries of Europe will get the chance to meet Trump there. He may even add on meetings on the end of that. We don't know that yet.
And did Pence reassure nervous countries on Europe's eastern fringe of the US's commitment to NATO? Because that's been a topic of some uncertainty in the campaign, and even since the new administration took office.
Yeah, well, he talked to the leaders of specifically Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine. So the optics of that, even for an unconventional administration such as this one, suggests that you're unlikely to go out of your way to publicly schedule those meetings if you're then going to leave them in the lurch. I mean, it's not necessarily certain that they were entirely comforting words, but I think it's likely that they were mostly so. He spoke to Angela Merkel as well in a one-to-one and then went on to Brussels and saw NATO and the EU. So it's clear that the idea of an aggressively isolationist administration from the very beginning, if that was ever true, isn't really being borne out quite yet.
So you mentioned he spoke to Angela Merkel, and Germany and France are under pressure again as a result of the conference to increase their defense spend in line with their NATO commitments. But strengthening NATO's position has implications for the EU's previously fairly open relationship with Russia. How do you see the Europeans managing this balancing act?
I think you're right that it is a balancing act, and I think the Europeans are going to want to have a bit of carrot to go with the stick, if you see what I mean. The idea that Pence's visit was always going to be completely reassuring was never really a goer. He was always going to come and reiterate that message that the US has been saying for a number of years now, way before this administration took office, that NATO members are committed to spending 2% of their GDP on defence, and very few of them are. Although it has been moving in that direction. So that's something. Obviously, that will make Russia nervous and fidgety, as we've seen in the last couple of years. So I think there's going to have to be some compensation for that. And we think the sanctions that have been in place from Europe towards Russia since the annexation of Crimea and since the MH17 incident, we think over the next couple of years they're going to be dialed back quite substantially. Not totally. But with the UK losing influence in Europe, the UK is the strongest proponent of the sanctions remaining in place. Then I think Germany, as the new government takes office there, is probably going to want to improve relations with Russia from an energy, from an exports point of view. So I think for business, I think there is stick to go with the carrot and carrot to go with the stick.
Something for businesses to watch out for then. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Maria, thanks. Just as it seems that globalization is taking a momentary time out, Brazil and Argentina have decided that this is the year to go global.
What are the prospects for these two resource-rich nations restoring the luster to their trade portfolio? I spoke to Tomas Favaro in our Sao Paulo office. Tomas, Argentina and Brazil are moving from a starkly protectionist system, which I think is fair to say was a failure by several measures, now to new administrations which are putting pretty much all their effort into moving ahead with a trade liberalization agenda. Why, and what will it look like?
Well, the first and most obvious driver is ideological change. So the ascension of center-right presidents in both countries in 2016 led to a reshuffling of foreign policy agendas, you know, including on trade. I think the second driver was, as you mentioned, lack of results. Even though Brazil and Argentina erected a range of protectionist barriers to shield their manufacturing sectors from foreign competition, both countries went through a period of deindustrialization over the past decade, with local companies struggling to compete. And last but not least, the deterioration of the two economies in recent years has also convinced government officials in both countries of the urgent need to improve access to global markets. So I think all of these factors have played a critical role in reshaping the foreign and trade policy agenda in South America.
Thanks. That paints a pretty clear picture of what's driving this change for Brazil and Argentina now. But trade liberalization in 2017? For me, it sounds like they're moving against the current a little bit. What do we think they can realistically achieve in the current climate?
Yes, the irony is that this policy shift comes at a time when much of the world is beginning to head in the opposite direction. We have seen this in the US with Trump's election, in Europe with Brexit, you know, anti-trade rhetoric is growing. So skeptical partners will undoubtedly be a major obstacle for Brazil and Argentina. For example, their much coveted agreement with the EU is very unlikely to become a reality in the short term. The prospects for 2017 are dim. Another significant deterrent is that the two countries, as members of the Mercosur trade bloc, need to negotiate potential agreements jointly. And recent history suggests that aligning priorities within the bloc has proven to be a major challenge. And unless they find a solution that allows countries to negotiate bilaterally, this will continue to be a significant hindrance to trade liberalization.
So there's a number of external factors, a pretty wide range of external factors pushing this change, and that might create an obstacle to it. But how much of a domestic consensus is there within Brazil and Argentina in favor of trade openness? Policy swings may suggest not everyone will be happy with this strategy.
Both countries are agriculture powerhouses that could benefit greatly from opening new markets. However, foreign competition is indeed regarded with deep suspicion by local industrialists, and unions are also traditionally skeptical of a trade openness. Luckily, however, there is a domestic agenda related to trade that is indeed consensual, such as the need to improve transport infrastructure and to reduce bureaucracy around foreign commerce. So we do expect positive results this year in the implementation of integrated single window custom systems, improved infrastructure, and other measures that can boost trade. So we do think investors will benefit from trade liberalization moves in the short term. It's just that dismantling decades of protectionism will undoubtedly take markedly longer.
Sure, and the pressure's on for the Argentine and Brazilian governments now. Thanks, Thomas.
Thank you.
Maria, thanks. Before we sign off, here's a look at some of the other topics we'll be thinking about in the coming weeks.
On Saturday, 25th of February, Kuwait celebrates its National Day. The Kuwaiti embassy in the U.S. plans to host its 600-guest National Day celebrations at the new Trump Hotel in Washington, drawing criticism as another illustration of U.S. President Donald Trump's potential conflict of interest in drawing business from foreign leaders who book rooms and meeting space there.
On Thursday, the 2nd of March, early elections for the devolved assembly in Northern Ireland will be held. The Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which supports Northern Ireland remaining part of the UK, is likely to see its vote share fall as the result of a scandal that caused the government to collapse in January. However, it is likely to return to power along with Sinn Féin, which campaigns for a united Ireland.
The week of Monday, 6 March, will see travel and supply chain disruption through the Philippines' main airport in Manila. Around 700 flights will be affected at Ninoy Aquino International Airport due to scheduled radar maintenance. That's it for the Risk Map podcast for the second half of February 2017. Find us every 2 weeks on Podbean, the Control Risk website, and iTunes. For more about risk and opportunity in 2017, don't forget to visit the Risk Map website on riskmap.controlrisks.com. This is Maria Knapp in London. Thanks for listening.
Maria, thanks for co-hosting and thanks for the chat. We look forward to getting in front of the microphones again in early March. Until then, thanks for listening. Asante and Kwaheri from Nairobi.